This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour this Monday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Coming up this half hour, it wasn't quite the torrential downpour seen in the eastern states over the weekend, but for a small group of graziers in the far west of New South Wales, a storm brought some of the best rain they've seen in years, and with it, some rain guilt. Also this lunchtime, as debate continues between the EU and Australia around geographical indicators, is there an opportunity to protect our own produce?
Australia's got it for wine, so think Coonawarra, Barossa, Margaret River, the Hunter. They've got protection GIs for wine, but we don't have it for food.
You'll hear from an Adelaide Hills cheesemaker on that after the weather. What South Australian food products, though, do you think we should seek protection for? 0467 922 891. What SA food products do you think should be protected? It could be cheese, meat. Hit me up with your suggestions. And thanks to the people playing on social media suggesting frog cakes and a chocolate snack and ice cream that I can't name because it is the ABC. 0467 922 891 if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also give us a call on 1300 at 222 891. It's 6 past 12 and first today, Australian Agriculture has a new minister, who happens to be an old one. Freshly minted Nationals Deputy David Littleproud returns to the portfolio he first held from December 2017 until May last year. Now he returns to the portfolio at a time when farmers are dealing with drought, fire and floods, but could uniting the Nationals be his greatest challenge?
Oh, well, we've been united. What happens in the National Party party room is very unique. We have a different psychology to everyone else. We simply go out, we talk about it, we get on with the job, and then we come out of that room, we shake hands and have a beer.
Who did you vote for in the leadership ballot?
What happens in the party room stays in the party room.
It does appear, though, that there has been a shift in the thinking of the National Party, lessons to be learnt from this leadership challenge. Already we've seen strong messaging from Leader Michael McCormack, sort of an anti-environment movement it's been interpreted as by some people. Will you be bringing that to your new portfolio of agriculture?
No, well, there's always lessons to be learned, and I think good leadership means that you're always listening, and that's what our party room makes sure our leaders always do, and we have a constructive environment to do that in the party room. In terms of the environment, I think we've got a proud record of stewardship of that as a government, and we'll continue to do that. And one of the key pieces that I was proud of before I finished up as Ag Minister last time was the Biodiversity Stewardship Fund. I think farmers in particular should be rewarded for the stewardship of their land, not just with a blunt instrument of carbon abatement, but also for improving their biodiversity and that stewardship of that, not only by through the Climate Solutions Fund, through carbon abatement, but paid a premium for that biodiversity improvement and markets. The markets are actually screaming. People want to know the provenance of their food and fibre. And if you can prove that and say that you've got a system that can be accredited, then Australian produce could have a biodiversity seal that will command even a higher price. So farmers would get rewarded in the marketplace, but also for their carbon abatement with a premium.
But how realistic is that?
Well, and that's where ANU and the NFF are ready to go. In fact, I had a conversation with the NFF yesterday. There's $4 million in the last budget I was able to get for the market mechanism, and there's $30 million to put the science around the mechanism to make sure that it fits within the Climate Solutions Fund. The ANU made it clear to me that it could all be done within 12 months. So the foot's on the accelerator now. I'm back in the chair and I intend to make sure that this is one of the key priorities that I'll be taking forward. I think this is a real opportunity for farmers to take advantage when we've got state governments that come over the top and put draconian legislation on them to be able to be rewarded for their stewardship of their land.
Is your return to the agriculture portfolio about seeing to unfinished business?
No, well, look, obviously, it's a great honour to be Agriculture Minister, particularly when you're from regional Australia. But I think that the business that I'd started was being continued on by Bridget, and unfortunately she was taken away from that role, and I think had she stayed, she would have continued on that trajectory.
So should she have stayed in the role?
Well, obviously she made the determination that she didn't believe that she could stay on. She resigned because she didn't meet the ministerial standards. And that's something I think you've got to say was took courage and class, and she took ultimate responsibility. And I think there's a few politicians who should look at that.
Well, this reshuffle has led to you leaving the water portfolio, something you've held since December of 2017. Why are you abandoning the Murray-Darling Basin at this important juncture?
Well, I'm not. Unfortunately, I've still got emergency management that needs my attention, and that's a significant part of responsibility, particularly with the fires. We've still got the North Queensland floods.
Did you want the water portfolio?
Obviously, I'd love to have kept it, but I can't do everything. And I've got to, the things that I've got to do properly, but I'm proud of my record on the Murray-Darling. In fact, in the 2 years I was Water Minister, I secured the Northern Basin Review that meant we didn't have to secure an extra 70 gigalitres of water in the Northern Basin, the sustainable diversion limits that meant that in the Southern Basin in particular, you could recover water with infrastructure, not buybacks, and the 450 neutrality test. I mean, that was akin to getting peace in the Middle East.
There's three reviews currently underway across the Murray-Darling Basin that you've led or called for. Can you understand how some people are frustrated that you're walking away from the portfolio at this time?
What I have done is made sure that there's a framework for the new minister, Keith Pitt, who I have utmost faith in. The framework is there for him to continue on. Mick Kilty's report will come back in a matter of weeks. The social and economic study comes back by April. And in fact, we're already working in a budget process to make sure that we have funds to support that in what that reconstruction might look like. And the ACCC has already done a body of work to make sure that we have a clear pathway of understanding what the water market should look like. And I think at the end of it, there'll be a philosophical conversation we have, whether those that don't produce anything should own water. And that's a philosophical conversation I think we should have as a nation, because water is a different commodity to gold or coal. Should the marketplace for water be the same as other commodities?
Should it?
Well, my philosophical view is no, it shouldn't. I think it's something that this water market has evolved into something that has gone far beyond what it was first intended to do. And I think now's the opportunity to look at it. But I don't have all the power, and the Commonwealth doesn't have all the power on this, because a lot of this comes back within states and the markets within each individual state. So that's why we've got to work.
Saying that water shouldn't be traded like a commodity?
Well, a commodity to an extent, but the market needs to be...
To what extent?
Well, so there's 14%. There's 14% of entitlement holders do not own land or produce anything. They're simply trading water. They're simply trading in and out. Is that really the intent of what we tried to do when we separated land and water back in the late 1990s? I don't think that was the intent. It was there for farmers.
Can you unscramble the egg?
Well, that won't happen straight away. I think if there is recommendations the ACCC comes forward with and a pathway forward, that will take time. You just can't walk in arbitrarily. You've got to make sure that you give time to make market changes. Market forces need to be respected and understood, the impacts, because there's some unintended consequences if you act too quickly, and that's why you get someone with expertise like the ACCC to look at it.
That's David Littleproud speaking with Kath Sullivan at Parliament House. Rob Keren is the chairman of Primary Producers SA, and he's currently at Gundawindi in Queensland. Good afternoon, Rob.
Good afternoon. How are we going?
Not too bad, thanks. First of all, what are you doing up in Queensland?
Basically, with the NFS, talking to the various irrigator groups across the basin, which is a bit of an effort to dispel the myths about what we do in South Australia and us to better understand what they do up here.
So you're standing up for downstream?
Yeah, just getting a few home truths through, hopefully. Particularly about Lock Zero, which is, in New South Wales in particular, is held up as a big hope for them of receiving much, much more irrigation water, which just doesn't add up with the science. So trying to debunk that along the way.
We also heard from New South Wales Water Minister Melinda Pavey on Friday on the Country Hour, basically urging the Queensland government to embargo pumping from unregulated flows. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, we've discussed that this morning, and there are embargoes on a lot of it. It was a bit of a strange situation there because, there's a lot of tension between, sort of the over-the-border stuff between Queensland and New South Wales. they tell me that with a lot of the embargoes anyway, the water is not up to the level where they can pump regardless. So perhaps it was a little bit of a storm in a teacup, that one.
Well, are you concerned at all with the new water minister in Keith Pitt being from Queensland and outside the basin?
Well, he's outside the basin, so there's not as much vested interest as there might be. But, we'll let him get across it for a week or so, and then hopefully we'll find out a bit more about what his thoughts may be going forward for the basin. Yeah, I think while the states run most things, I think the Commonwealth Government's got a very, very important role to play. I think we need to look at what the role of the MDBA is. Some of the talk here this morning has been about the myths that surround what other states do and whatever. I think we need... the MDBA is probably best to be the honest broker who tests all the claims scientifically and sort of debunks, because some of the myths are very misleading, and they actually give irrigators hope that they're going to get something, which they're obviously not.
The other person to pick up a role, one that they've done before already, that is David Littleproud as the new Ag Minister, or the returning Ag Minister. We've just heard from him on the Country Hour. Are you glad that he's back in that role?
Yeah, no, we welcome it. He's had experience with it. He's also, you know, the drought's probably still the big issue. Certainly looking out the window, there's some relief around for some people. But we're well and truly not out of the woods. So having David had drought when he was the minister, and then he had drought on its own. So he's got a good grip on it. Really, it's good to not be changing ministers this way through the drought policy discussions and whatever else. So certainly welcome that. And he also is sort of the drought resilience fund. The next few months are going to be important as how that's used. So that continuity of Minister Littleproud is really important to us.
Apart from the drought, what else are you hoping he prioritises this year?
Oh, I think that the FTA is a real issue for us at the moment, and while that's the major carriage of Minister Birmingham, we need the Ag Minister in there pushing for what agriculture want out of the various FTAs. The EU one is going to be a big issue going forward. Massive opportunity for us, but geographic indicators, subsidies, a whole range of issues being put on the table with that. The UK, I think, is probably a little bit easier than the EU, but again, that's an opportunity for us. China, India, Indonesia, which is a focus today, but... I think there's some real opportunities going forward. We need a strong Ag Minister who's across those to make sure we maximise what Ag can get out of it.
And just on the EU negotiations, because we're going to touch on that a little bit later on the program, really sort of looking at whether, as you said, there are opportunities here in South Australia, and whether South Australian producers should be seeking protection through federal legislation for food products here in South Australia. What do you think about that?
Yeah, look, that's, as long as they're willing to go through all the hassle with compliance and checking and whatever, I think there's some opportunities there. Certainly the EU have made a bit of an art form of geographic indicators and sort of stopping other people from doing things. I think that'll be a big issue when we come to the FTA with the EU. There's only so much we can do, but we'd like to stop them creating, behind names, creating regions like they did with Prosecco. Where they've named it, or renamed a region Prosecco, and then try to stop other people from using the name.
Rob Karen, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Rob Karen, Chairman of Primary Producers SA.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And it is 19 past 12, and I should add 0467 922 891 is the number to really send me your suggestions on what South Australian food products you think should be protected. I'll be speaking to an Adelaide Hills cheesemaker after the weather, but I'd love to hear your suggestions. 0467 922 891. 891. Now, you would have seen huge falls of rain in parts of Queensland and New South Wales at the weekend. The Far West has been on the lookout for rain for a long time, and fortunately for some, a narrow band of rain fell in parts of the region over the weekend, providing welcome relief for some drought-affected graziers. Chris Bright was one of the lucky ones. He lives at Kimberley Station, 140 kilometres south of Broken Hill. Saskia Mabin has more.
The last time we had a rain like that, and I know exactly when it was, the end of 2017.
Chris Bright recorded 12 millimetres of rain at his home and up to 47 millimetres around his property from multiple rainfall events over the weekend. And in true Far West form, with the rain came dust storms.
Yeah, we had one yesterday too. You know, we had 2 mil yesterday morning, woke up and it was raining, which was, you know, just amazing at the moment how things are happening. And then in the afternoon there and that, for 2 or 3 hours, it went all red in the sky, and then we had a shower of rain about 5 o'clock, and washed it all out again there. So it's just, at the moment, the weather is just incredible, and it's all coming from the east, which is never usually happens for us.
Mr. Bright said the recent rainfall represents 12 months of fresh water for his property and was an immense relief.
We were living on the edge, and what I mean is we can never go away for more than a day. We've got a desalination plant we run day in, day out to water the stock, to keep their house going, and to do the garden. So if we have a day off and we go away for a day, we've got to pump. It takes us a couple of days to catch back up again. So if we run the desal every day, and it's just, you know, and you're always thinking, well, if it breaks down, the bore breaks down or something like that. We can't let the water get down.
Across the Far West, rainfall was patchy, and Mr. Bright said while the news was good for him, he felt sorry for others who had missed out entirely.
I get a bit of the rain guilt because I've got good friends that didn't get anything there. Like, probably five or six stations around us got a really good rain. But you go outside of that circle there on that, and most people have had nothing. So it just makes you feel, you know, you're really happy, but you think, gee whiz, it could have been a bit more widespread.
Lachlan Gall lives at Langawira Station, 130 kilometres northeast of Broken Hill. The weekend's rain didn't fill any of his dams, but Mr. Gall said it freshened them up, with up to 21 millimetres of rain falling on parts of his property. Like Mr. Bright, Lachlan Gall said receiving even a small amount of rain made him feel guilty.
Yeah, I've definitely got a case of the rainfall guilt at the moment, despite that shower we had yesterday morning being our highest single day rainfall recording since September 2016, when our neighbours and pretty much the whole Far West of New South Wales didn't get anything. It's frustrating to see that heavy rain falling in eastern New South Wales at the moment, and we're just wishing that it would come a bit further west very soon. Most of our neighbours received nothing, and to be honest, the rain here wasn't a general rain event. It was a narrow strip through the middle of the place with the heaviest straight over the top of our rain gauge. When it was falling, it felt like it was everywhere. So it was a bit demoralising to find out that it was pretty much over the top of the house and 20% of the property here and not general over the whole Far West of New South Wales.
Mr. Gall said the drought hasn't broken and the rain he received isn't enough to significantly improve his feed situation.
What we need and the whole area needs is an extended period of above average rainfall to get the feed started from scratch and keep it going. And a single little shower like this won't do that. So we're desperately hoping that there will be significant continued rainfall.
Graziers are wary but optimistic. And Chris Bright is confident there'll be more rain on the way soon.
We were just waiting because we've got trees here that are probably 200-year-old that are dying. And we for the whole ecology of the property, we really, really were desperate like everybody else. But this will get us the start. I've never seen a time that after a drought that it's rained, it's never rained again. So it will rain again now and we'll be away, you know. But it'll take 2 or 3 months to get going again. But after the next couple of rains, it will be away.
That is Grazier Chris Bright from Kimberley Station in the far west of New South Wales, finishing that report by Saskia Mabin. And some mallee towns also caught a bit of a drink, particularly at Karoonda, where 29 millimetres fell in just over an hour on Friday afternoon. Let's find out if there is any more rain forecast. It's good afternoon to senior forecaster Simon Timke. Hi, Simon.
G'day, Isabella.
Is there any more rain on the way this week?
Not a lot to speak of this week. We're sort of under the influence of a high pressure ridge across waters to our south. We've got the trough over the eastern states, which is contributing to all the rainfall that we're seeing over New South Wales and eastern Victoria over the sort of last couple of days and continuing today. And that trough, it does move slowly towards us and gets to a position near our eastern border on Thursday and Friday, but we're really on the drier side of the trough rather than the wetter side. So for the rest of today, I think dry conditions right across the state, and there is a trough moving across the west today, which might bring a little bit of dust in the far west of the northwest pastoral district. Maybe just a slight chance of a light shower about the coast west of Nullarbor there, but no significant totals expected. And then over the following couple of days, we stay in an onshore airstream. So generally, sort of cooler conditions near the coast in that more southerly airstream. Could be the slight chance or slight to medium chance of a shower near southern coasts and ranges for Tuesday and again on Wednesday. Then weakening on Thursday. Wednesday and Thursday both have a slight chance of a shower and a possible thunderstorm right up in the very far northwest of the state. And then Friday, Saturday, sort of similar to Tuesday and Wednesday, with just a slight to medium chance of a shower near southern coasts and ranges. And then Sunday, Monday into next week looks like dry conditions right across the state. In that sort of southwest to southeasterly airstream, keeping temperatures a little bit lower in the south, but very hot conditions continuing across the north. So really quite a stable weather pattern at the moment with not too much changing over the next week or so. So what rainfall totals we are expecting are on the lower side. So for that four-day period out until midnight Friday, generally anywhere that sees a shower, we would expect less than 2 millimetres. But local falls of 2 to 5 possible, sort of close to southern coasts. But generally speaking, mostly dry conditions across the state for the next week, Isabella.
So not no warnings for today?
That's correct. Yeah, we don't have any warnings current. I think today and tomorrow we'll see sea breezes freshen near the coast, and there's a slight chance that it could be somewhere that would locally pick up a bit of a strong sea breeze. But at this point, I think that'd be localised enough that we don't require even any coastal warnings. But we'll have another look at that this afternoon to see whether tomorrow, maybe Wednesday, would be a widespread enough area to pick up some strong winds in coastal sea breezes. But other than that, generally just sort of moderate strength southwest to southeasterly winds over most of the state, freshening up a little bit each afternoon with some sea breezes in the south.
And will there be any effects really from the cyclone off the Western Australian coast?
At this stage, no. Looking on the satellite picture, we are seeing a bit of higher cloud stream into the far northwest of the state resulting from that. But I don't think it's going to produce any showers out of it, apart from perhaps right up in that far northwest on Wednesday and Thursday, where there might be the chance of a shower or a possible thunderstorm, but hardly getting to into South Australia. It'll mostly be over Western Australia and the Northern Territory, and just that slight chance in the very far northwest. So unfortunately, not really gaining much from that one either, Isabella.
We're missing out all over the place.
We are, as we've got weather to our east and weather to our west, and it's mostly dry in the middle. So we have missed out a little bit out of this rainfall. So we'll have to keep our eyes out for the next one. But yeah,
indeed,
certainly short term, mostly dry here.
Okay, thanks for that, Simon. Simon Timke at the Weather Bureau there. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the upper western district, tomorrow is going to be a hot and mostly sunny day with a medium chance of showers in the southeast and a slight chance elsewhere. There'll also be the chance of a thunderstorm in the east. Overnight, it's going to be around 20 degrees, then getting up to 36. And for the lower western district, a partly cloudy day with a medium chance of showers in the east and a slight chance elsewhere, again a chance of a thunderstorm as well. Overnight a bit cooler at 18 and then getting up to around 34 degrees. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're looking at these negotiations between the EU and Australia and whether there is South Australian produce that we should be protecting.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, great to have your company this afternoon. Coming up this half hour, Europe wants to protect its feta and Prosecco. Well, what about South Australian produce? What foods should be protected in South Australia? 0467 922 891 to hit me up with your suggestions. You can also call 1300 222 891. It might be cheese, it might be meat. Hit me up with your suggestions on which South Australian produce you think should be protected. 0467 922 891. We're also going to take a look at augmented reality and how that's going to help Australia's agriculture industry.
The real magic about what we were looking at doing was how do we take computer vision systems, which essentially process an image of an animal or process an image of a carcass in real time and determine things like the percentage of fat in a cut of meat or the colour of the cut of meat or the colour of the fat or the depth of fat.
That story is coming up in the next 20 minutes. It is just after 12:30 with the latest in news headlines. It's good afternoon to Claire Campbell.
Good afternoon, Isabella. Making news this afternoon, the state ombudsman has found two teenagers were propelled into the adult prison system and denied humane care in Adelaide's youth training centre. The latest damning report has slammed the treatment of the two boys who were aged 17 at the time. The neighbours of a man who was assaulted during a break-in at a house at Oaklands Park in Adelaide's West this morning believe the incident was a case of mistaken identity. Police are investigating a fatal cattle truck crash on the South Australia-Victoria border. A livestock truck hit a tree on Eden Hope Panola Road. The driver died at the scene and a number of animals have also been killed. And in New South Wales, the Weather Bureau says rain has caused some of the biggest floods in Sydney's rivers in more than 30 years. I'll be back at 1 o'clock with more ABC News.
Thanks, Claire. It is 28 minutes to 1, and we've talked a bit about Europe's push to protect certain foods under the Geographical Indications Program, things like feta, Gruyere and Roquefort. Well, a delegation from the EU recently met with food producers and farmers on King Island off Tasmania to hear how they've overcome some branding challenges. And perhaps there's some opportunities here in South Australia to protect the food that we produce. Eden Heinonen spoke to Duncan McPhee from the King Island Brand Management Group about the visit.
Bond University in Queensland wrote a paper on us and a bunch of other folks years ago about the possibility of geographical indicator protection. And they did a follow-up paper just recently to see how things were tracking for us. And somehow the European Union ambassador to Australia got wind of it all. And he thought it would be good to bring a bunch of European Union ambassadors to the island to look at what we do and have some conversations. And wow, we have some conversations.
How'd it go? What did you guys chat about?
Look, it was quite an extraordinary event. Certainly, we did have the lead negotiator for the Australia-EU free trade agreement was there. And not for a second was this anything formal. It was more about taking the temperature on things. And look, we learnt quite a bit through it. I know there's been talk about, you know, you won't be able to use the term brie for cheese in the future. Well, it's just not true. Brie is a cheese by itself. The region in France is Brie de Mont, so brie from de Mont. that there's no issue there. There's no issue with using the word pizza. There's no issue with using the term camembert. So it was good to understand some of the intricacies.
Were there any products or drinks that maybe we won't be able to use in future?
Look, not that we covered at all. We examined it really from just a King Island lens, looking at what we produce here, and there was nothing here that would be affected from a name type of thing. The question would be, if we were able to get the federal government to put legislation in place for geographical indicators for food, Australia's got it for wine. So think Coonawarra, Barossa, Margaret River, the Hunter. They've got protection GIs for wine, but we don't have it for food. And it has to be, for example, the lobster on King Island, the folks that do the distribution of it here assure me, is different to lobster from everywhere else around Australia. That would be an example of where we could put a GI in place for lobster because it is specific to here. If we could prove that the beef grown on King Island is different to the beef grown elsewhere, which is quite possible because we've certainly done taste tests before and we come out on top, but if we can prove that there is a difference, then you can put a GI there. If it's, I'm just trying to think of something really generic that would be the same on King Island elsewhere, then you can't put a GI on it. So it has to be something specific to that area that has a, I don't know, as the French would say, a je ne sais quoi, something special,
right.
To make it from that area.
So you had a delicious dinner for about 7 hours and you had some casual chats. What's the next step in this relationship?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Look, the first step is to get our brand management group back together and say, hey, do we want to push for federal legislation in the GI space and take the temperature there? It could be that, I know the lobster folks are keen to do something, so it might be that we just take one product and push that through. I believe there are some initial steps afoot at getting federal legislation going, but I haven't been a part of any of those conversations, but I think we need to be. We just need to find out where the feds are at with all of this, because we can't do anything as a little local place and we can't do anything on a state basis. It has to be national legislation, is my understanding.
Of the conversations you had that night, what was the most interesting thing that you learnt from these delegates?
Do you know, it's a really good question, because I thought I understood GIs pretty well and the concept of GIs, but the European Union ambassador to Australia, he just added one component that I stupidly had not connected, and it is this. As much as we understand GIs are about the provenance of product, it's also about keeping jobs in rural and remote communities. And I had just not quite made that connection. I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but I mean, it makes perfect sense when you hear it. But in France in particular, there is a lot of effort about keeping rural communities going. And the GI protection stuff is part of that.
That's Duncan McPhee, chair of the King Island Brand Management Group. Some of your suggestions coming through on South Australian food products that we should be protecting. Someone saying Manuka honey. Shell from the Mallee saying, please make sure no one steals or abuses our Fritz or Metwurst. We do it better than anywhere else in the world. Thanks for that, Shell. 0467 922 891. If you'd like to give me your suggestion for a South Australian food product that you think should be protected. Chris Lloyd is the head cheesemaker at Woodside Cheese Rights in the Adelaide Hills. Good afternoon, Chris.
Yes, good afternoon, Isabella. How are you?
Good, thanks. Amidst the negotiations between the EU and Australia, is there actually an opportunity here for South Australian producers? Should they be seeking protection for food products based on provenance?
Look, I actually think it is an incredible opportunity for us, you know, to really consider what we have here that is really quite special. And, you know, I mean, to add to your list, things like, as you said, you know, there's the honey, but there's honey from Kangaroo Island, from the Ligurian bees. There's beautiful pulses from Kangaroo Island as well. We've got the prawns from the Spencer Gulf. We've got the oysters from Coffin Bay. And I mean, look, there I go on and on and on. So I think, yeah, look, there's a there really is a great opportunity for us to stake our claim on some of the incredible foods that that our regions produce. It's just something that I think if we've got the opportunity to put it on the table and really have a good look at it, and obviously get the expert advice, like your previous interviewee was talking about, I think there's a lot that we can certainly learn, and protecting it now seems to be a very good opportunity.
There has been some concern from some in the dairy industry about not being able to potentially use words like feta. Do you share that concern?
Look, I don't necessarily, because I've been making cheese now for almost 22 years, and most of my cheeses have names. Well, I mean, I have a cheese that's called the Jolly Swagman, for instance, which is a feta halloumi style with Australian river mint right through it. I have cheeses called Figaro. I've got a cheese called Edith. So I've always stepped outside the square, if you like, or the circle, whichever one you would like, and try to do things a little bit differently and use a different name. I've always felt that I have the confidence in my products to not have to name them a generic name. I guess the thing is with generic names, like Brie, Camembert and feta, the thing there is that it is something that people resonate with. You know, you go into a store and you know that you're going to buy a piece of feta, or you're going to buy a brie or a camembert for your cheese plate, whether that comes from Australia or whether it comes from France or some other part of the world, you know what you're actually looking for. For somebody to come in and buy a Jolly Swagman, well, therein lies, a bit of difficulty, but that's then obviously up to my branding and up to my marketing to get my message across about what I'm trying to do. So far, so good. Most of my cheeses, and we make over 20 or so different cheeses, are recognised just for the name that we've decided to name them.
I'm thinking of in Denmark, they had to change the name of feta to white cheese cubes. I mean, whatever the alternative option may be, would it need to be consistent across the whole industry to avoid confusion from consumers?
I think it would be, yes, definitely. So, for example, it could be Jolly Swagman, which is called frying cheese, let's say, if it was a halloumi, that's probably not one of the greatest terms, but yes, I think that there just would definitely need to be a generic term. So if it did come to the point where we couldn't use something like brie and camembert, I think we'd have to have complete industry buy-in that, okay, let's just say, for argument's sake, an Australian brie is going to be called a bloomy rind, let's say, because it blooms, just off the top of my head. And then you might give it, a name. So, for instance, ours is called Charleston, the brie style cheese that we make. And that is named after the town where we actually source our milk. But for us to still be competitive, because obviously you don't want to be introducing something like this and then not being competitive in that marketplace. But for us to be competitive, we would need to have a big marketing campaign around this in order for people to understand that that's actually what the Australian equivalent is called.
I'm speaking to Chris Lloyd, who is the head cheesemaker at Woodside Cheese Rights. Chris, you operate in a high-end food space where story and provenance is key. But what about bulk production, where much of the dairy production, for instance, goes to? What are sort of the challenges there when you're looking at names?
Yeah, look, I think that that's a completely, you know, it is a little bit of a different ball game, especially when they're producing, as you say, bulk mozzarella and, you know, bocconcinis and whatever else. So, again, it would need to have, definitely need to have industry buy-in. And I guess the thing is, you know, it's interesting because you look at some of the producers of a lot of those, particularly the pasta filata cheeses, which are the soft stretching sort of cheeses. You know, these are migrants that have come to Australia and brought those recipes here and have really staked a claim and really brought that tradition alive here in Australia. So it's a tricky one, you know. I don't think it's a silver bullet kind of thing, you know, maybe, you know, one side fits all. So, you know, those producers have really brought that industry alive in Australia. I would think that they'd be quite reluctant to want to change the terminology or the naming of some of those cheeses. My situation is very different, as you say, because I am high-end, high-value add, you know, it's a different, yeah, I think it's definitely a different conversation to be had there. But the reason to consider some of this is definitely the fact that we are producing and we have access to some of the finest quality raw material in the world, you know, really world class.
How much of this, Chris, is just marketing, and how much of this is actually looking at unique products that Australia produces? Because we've had someone text in questioning whether the previous interview was talking about King Island lobster, and they're questioning whether King Island lobster is actually unique to that region. So how much of it is marketing versus unique produce?
Look, I think definitely there is a component of marketing there, but I think that we do have some really unique ingredients and unique regions and products in Australia. You know, for instance, the green ants that, you know, I mean, we make a cheese and we put green ants on it, and it's the only one of its kind in the world. Some of our native ingredients, for instance. So, you know, the lemon myrtle, we've got saltbush, outback bush tomatoes. So there's a number of different ingredients that are very, very unique to Australia. And one of the things, these things grow in abundance in our country. So this is why I incorporate those ingredients in my products, because I feel that it's a really wonderful way for us to be able to tell the Australian cheese story through using native ingredients and ingredients in abundance in our country. So, yes, it's about marketing, but also we do have some very, very unique, you know, particularly obviously the Ligurian bees in Kangaroo Island. These are very, very unique to our country.
Chris, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That is Chris Lloyd, the head cheesemaker at Woodside Cheese Rights in the Adelaide Hills. What do you think? What South Australian products do you think we'd have a case for protecting? 0467 922 891 to send me your suggestions. Still to come, you're going to hear how augmented reality is going to help Australia's agriculture industry.
Time for us to throw open our windows and say what's on everyone's lips.
The best form of welfare is a job.
Must-see appointment television.
And how did you come by?
Just stumbled across it when I was flicking through the channels.
Hosted by Australia's favourite white middle-aged male, but with enough gender diversity to choke a horse.
Take them to the lid-opening mines!
And the occasional lefty joke so we don't look biased.
I like the CFM of you, man. He was really scary.
Mad as hell. Wednesday, 8:30 on ABC TV and iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's 12 minutes to one. Thanks for your company this Monday afternoon. Connecting school students and local industry to collaborate on research opportunities is what a Cummins local would use a $10,000 bursary for if she was named the SA Rural Woman of the Year. Kelly Taylor has a background in nanotechnology and runs EP analysis in Cummins. If she takes home the title, she wants to encourage students to look locally for Year 12 research
research project ideas. She told Brooke Neindorf it's an idea she's had brewing for a while now.
I've been working on it for just over 2 years now, but it's been growing for a long time. So I guess it started when I first left school. I did all my schooling at Cummins, and I didn't really intend to return because I didn't think there was any innovation and science opportunities in the area. I was really shocked when I did come back and start a small business here to see how much cool things are happening around the area. All these small businesses are doing some amazing research and have the capacity to do so much more research with some of the ideas they've got as well. So that was sort of the starting point of thinking about why I left in the first place, I guess. When I thought, oh, there's so many ideas here already. Why did I go?
Tell us about the pitch that you put to the panel and the idea that you want to try and get up and running.
It was much along the same way. I pointed out that I was originally from the area and I left because I didn't think there was many opportunities. And then when I came back, I realised there was lots of opportunities and I sort of wondered whether there was some way we could nurture our youth to see innovation and entrepreneurial skills before they even left. So the hope is that we can show them what's in the area, get them all excited about what they could be involved in the area before they leave, and hopefully not leave, but if they do leave, hopefully come back with their new learnt skills and give small business a try, give their own entrepreneurial idea a try.
So it might not necessarily be something down the same path that you do every day with a science area, but maybe something that an idea that a farmer's come up with or another small business has got an idea that they'd like to maybe put some research into but maybe haven't got the time or just need a bit of extra hand with.
Yeah, definitely. The idea is that if someone has I wonder what happens if, or I wish this did that, you know, we're on the coal face out here in the country where we're doing our work in challenging environments, we're problem solving every day. So it's an opportunity then to connect these what if moments and these ideas to, say, for example, the school research project. So have a student that then comes into to do the collaborative research and achieve that, answering that question, basically.
Because for a lot of kids, they hear the word research project, and it's been something that has been part of SACE for a few years now, and often they're going, oh, what am I going to look at, or what can I research as part of this? I guess if there's that option for them to have a bit of a list of things that might be something they're interested in, I guess that makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah, so when I went over to university, I did a summer research project, and I remember the awe thing, like looking at the booklet of all the research projects we could undertake, like just short-term research projects. And that's the idea that I want to capture and bring back here, is that we present to the school a booklet of localized research ideas based on our own local issues that we can then inspire our youth to come up with answers together and then hopefully, yeah, do something with it in the future.
Is it something you can see be broadened out even more and go sort of statewide or Australia-wide?
Yeah, definitely. So there's, at the moment, it easily targets the Year 12 research project, fits into that really nicely. But there's also the community studies, say stage one topic, and that could easily accommodate it. And that's something that is Australia-wide. So there's no reason why once a pilot program has been proofed up that it couldn't be adopted Australia-wide.
I guess if you look at what you've, this idea that you've come up with at the moment, let's look forward sort of maybe 10 years' time. What can you see? What would be your hope that's happening in 10 years' time here in Cummins?
Oh, not just for Cummins. What I think the ultimate goal would be is to get companies like CSIRO considering our schools as an opportunity to do research. With the drought problems and the bushfire problems, Woodner, for example, is a drought area. So why not use their school and their research capabilities to actually start looking at solutions or looking at different options? Yeah, I just think that it could involve bigger players than just small businesses.
That's Kelly Taylor from Cummins, one of this year's South Australian Rural Women Awards finalists, and you'll hear from the other three finalists over the next couple of weeks. It is 7:07, and there are a number of ag tech companies circling Australia's red meat sector at the moment, looking for opportunities to improve parts of the supply chain. Brett Whisker is the Chief Future Officer for Wiley and has been looking closely at the job of meat grading. Now, meat grading is what drives the valuation of every carcass and every cut of meat in Australia. But the job can be very tedious and it can be very subjective. And that's where the opportunity for technology exists. Mr. Whisker is speaking here to Matt Bran.
So with meat grading, the biggest challenge from our perspective looking at it is that we have, you know, a couple of hundred people around the country who are charged with grading. The standards have been developed to quite a high level, but essentially we have human beings who are doing very repetitive tasks in rather challenging environments day in and day out collecting these data points. So to assert that across the board, the couple of hundred people around the country that are doing this day in and day out are doing it consistently, and that someone doing it in Rockhampton is doing it to the same standards as someone doing it in Murray Bridge in South Australia. To assert that they are doing it consistently across the board is just a little bit delusionary on behalf of anybody who thinks that it has that degree of consistency to it. So we did some work with the MLA a couple of years ago looking at how could we actually bring about a higher degree of objectivity. So how do we capture this information and do it in a much more objective fashion?
And what did you find?
Well, part of the theory is that, you know, a lot of the subjective elements are done with visual assessments. So you're talking about somebody taking the colour of a piece of meat or the number of square centimetres of a piece of meat by actually putting a clear plastic grid across a cut of meat and actually counting the square centimetres. And, you know, by the time you've counted the square centimetres on a cut of meat 400 times in a day, it probably becomes quite tedious. So there is an opportunity there to start to assist people in that area. So what we looked at with this was how could computer vision systems collaborate with a meat grading individual and actually help them do their job better.
And that took you down a route of augmented reality, yeah?
Yeah, so the real magic about what we were looking at doing was how do we take computer vision systems, which essentially process an image of an animal or process an image of a carcass in real time and determine things like the percentage of fat in a cut of meat or the colour of the cut of meat or the colour of the fat or the depth of fat at a particular point. All of that's done with a computer vision piece of software. So if I took a photograph with my smartphone of a piece of meat, I could run that software and actually do those determinations. But what we needed was a computer vision system that was accessible to someone who was actually busy with their hands doing a job and couldn't take a phone out of their pocket 700 times a day while they take an image and do that sort of process. So we did an assessment of the various different augmented reality pieces of technology, hardware that existed in that point in time in the market, and then set about using one of those pieces of technology to build a proof of concept on an augmented reality system that would work for meat grading.
And so is this something we're now going to see in Meatworks?
From our perspective, what we did was a proof of concept to prove that this is a piece of technology that is going to come down the pipeline. There are other ways that meat grading is being addressed. I think what we've determined is we're going to see augmented reality solutions in food processing around the world in the relatively near term. I'm talking sort of 2 to 5 years, it'll be used as a decision support system. How do you make somebody better at the job that they're doing? Will it come into meat grading? The jury's still a little bit out on that. We're continuing to work on that and looking at some different ways it can come to bear. One of the things that we've identified is that there's potentially a greater opportunity for meat inspection. So meat inspection is done in an abattoir where we're looking for reasons why an individual carcass should be removed from the supply chain. So we're talking about something in the animal's makeup or its health that might mean that it shouldn't be eaten. And so that's done with a meat inspection phase. And so meat inspectors in an abattoir are looking for, you know, anything up to 30 or 40 different symptoms or conditions, and that's quite a challenging process as well. So I think the technology that we built, we're still considering it from a meat grading perspective, but, you know, I think augmented reality is something we're going to see a lot more of.
And for our audience, do you mind, I probably should jump in, and, you know, we might have people listening who have got no idea what augmented reality is.
Sure.
Is it easy to explain, Nick, compared to virtual reality, which people might be a bit more familiar with?
Virtual reality would be a headset that you would put on and it would stop you seeing the outside world and it would present a virtual interface. So it might allow you to be in a fantasy world or you know, be on the moon or be in a football stadium on the other side of the world. Augmented reality is there are categories of augmented reality, and so a heads-up display on a car windscreen is actually augmented reality because it's augmenting what you see. It's putting a piece of data between you and the real world and helps you understand the real world better. So that's the category of augmented reality. The most common use of the term would be something like a Google Glass, which is essentially a set of smart glasses. So imagine the technology that exists in a smartphone, but it's integrated into a set of goggles or a set of spectacles that you wear, and it actually has the ability to see what you can see and process some of that information, but also has the ability to display things in front of your eyes that aren't actually there. So, you know, in the case of red meat grading, we can put a crosshair on a piece of meat and the individual can use their voice to take a photo of that piece of meat, and that photo can then be processed by the processor within the augmented reality headset.
That is Wiley's Chief Future Officer, Brett Whisker. Sonia Feldoff is on your radio after one. Good afternoon, Sonia.
Hello, Isabella. The state government's going to look at new legislation to see better information sharing between private health providers and public ones. So what does that mean for your information? We'll get some reactions from doctors and health consumers after one. And there's a blue tree that's appeared in the Riverland in Loxton. So why is it creating the controversy that was never intended in the beginning? We'll explain more after.
Thanks, Sonia. On your radio after 1 and after 1.30 across regional South Australia and Broken Hill. That is it for us this Monday. I'll be back with you tomorrow. It's coming up to news time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.